Hello and welcome to the December episode of Our Science, the podcast bringing you updates from across the Royal Society. I'm Chloe.
And I'm Mara Clone.
This month we're talking about science careers and looking at some of the skills that help scientists develop beyond their labs.
We'll be hearing from researchers who have been learning how to interact with the media, how to be effective leaders and manage their teams, as well as talking to some of the participants in the Royal Society's MP sparing scheme.
We'll also be hearing interviews conducted by students from Britannia Village Primary School and Wimbledon College, where they got the chance to ask a scientist. So let's get started.
Engaging with the media is an important part for many scientists' work. But ensuring that your research is communicated accurately and effectively can be tricky. We host a media skill workshop here at the Royal Society, at which researchers can learn a bit more about how science is covered in the press and how to communicate their work.
At one of the recent training days, we caught up with two of the attendees, Dr. Vardis Toutakis, a Royal Society University Research Fellow from the University of Warwick, and Dr. Eliza Antolin from the University of Nottingham. And they spoke to us about the relationship between scientists, the media, and the public.
My name is Vardis Toutakis. I'm a Royal Society University Fellow. I'm based in Warwick University. I'm working in the field of plant-microbe interactions. And my main interest is how pathogen perception from plants can cause epigenetic marks in the plant genome.
So you're here today for the Media Skills Training Day at the Royal Society. What was it about the course that attracted you, and why do you think it's important to be able to communicate with the media well?
Communicating with the media, especially our days, is a very important thing. It's not only because we're using taxpayers' money to do our research, but also it's very important for us to educate the public about science and how we do science and what we can discover through science.
What factors do you think are important in trying to communicate with the media? What do you think helps you to do that well? Where do you think scientists fail in trying to communicate with the public?
We scientists often fail communicating with the public because we're not used to it. And in reality, we have never been trained to. That's why workshops like this one here, the one in the Royal Society, is so important. As a plant scientist, I think it's very important to communicate with the public because we have to change the public opinion about transgenic crops, which now we know are perfectly safe and can really help us supply more food for this world. But unfortunately, the public still is opposing to that, especially here in UK. So it will be very important for us to communicate how we can use transgenic crops and how transgenic crops are now safe for everybody.
My name is Eliza Antolin. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Nottingham. I am a physicist and I work on solar energy. What we're trying to do is we're trying to develop new solar energy technologies that are more affordable so that we can really generate a significant part of the power that we use with solar resources. So the idea is that the devices that we make have to be more efficient in the sense that they give us more electricity from the sun energy.
Why do you think it's important to communicate well with the media and through the media with the public?
I think it is important because nowadays we have to face different problems like climate change and the problem of contaminating, polluting energies that we're using. And to face those problems, I think it's important that the public gets conscious and well-informed. And I think we have to make an effort to try and inform them really well, because sometimes we want to catch their attention and then we just try to make things very exciting and we are not accurate and we don't really help them understand. And we really have to make an effort and learn how to make the public know what climate change is, what the problems are, and how we can solve them, because it's their decision at the end.
What factors do you think are particularly important in working with the media and engaging the public? What do you think works well, and where do you think scientists often get it wrong?
I think scientists get it wrong mostly because we're too technical, I suppose, when we talk. We are not used to talk without using certain words and expressions, and we just have to learn. And also, we don't know how to make people imagine what we're talking about, and that's something we really have to learn, because we don't need some images anymore, because we're so used to the things we work with that we forget how they look or what they really are, because we see them every day. And we really have to learn to go back and talk about that again so that people really understand us.
The next Royal Society Media Skill Training Day will be in February 2014, and you can find out more details about it through our website. Visit royalsociety.org/training.
We run several training courses for Royal Society Research Fellows, and in October we hosted a course on leadership effectiveness at the Royal Society at Chichley Hall as part of a series on innovation and business skills. At the two-day conference, there were sessions on leadership, motivation, negotiation and team management, and we chatted to the researchers at different stages in their careers to see why they thought these were useful skills for scientists.
Two Royal Society University Research Fellows, Dr. Diego Altamirano from the University of Southampton and Professor Nicole Gropert, Professor of Nanomaterials at the University of Oxford, and two Royal Society Wolfson Research Merit Award holders, Professor Gert Arts from Swansea University and Professor Heiko Balzer from the University of Leicester, told us why they had decided to come along and what they had got out of the course.
Hi, my name is Gert Arts. I'm a professor in theoretical particle physics in Swansea University. And I've been in Swansea since 2004, for 10 years now.
Why did you think it would be useful for you to come here?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great opportunity that the Royal Society offers this kind of opportunity, because it's something that you don't encounter a lot in your day-to-day job. So first of all, it's an exciting opportunity. And second of all, as you progress in your university career, at some point you have to take on more leadership roles. And so this is one way to learn about how to do it and how not to do it. So that's very useful.
What do you hope that you can take back and apply when you go back to your daily life?
I think what was very useful is what makes a good leader. Often in universities, people take on a leading role because nobody else wants to do it. And that does not make them a good leader, obviously. And so to be a good leader, you have to invest a little bit more in why you want to be a leader and what would make you a good leader. So it's good to do it not out of necessity, but out of willingness to do it.
And do you think there are particular reasons that for scientists it's useful to have a chance to have this kind of training?
I think so. Scientists always work in a very idiosyncratic way. So we have our labs or our office, and you are used to talking with students and postdocs. But that always works in a certain dynamic, which is kind of fixed by the environment. And so when you do something outside of that, you suddenly deal with completely different people, maybe human resources or people in a different science, who have a different scientific background. And then you're suddenly confronted with this different culture, which you're not aware of, have not encountered before. So it's good to be aware of that.
My name is Diego Altamirano. I am in the University of Southampton, and I work in astronomy, in the study of black holes.
And we're here at the innovation course. Why were you interested in attending this course?
So I just got the Royal Society Fellowship, and this is giving me the opportunity to build my own research group. And that means that I will have to be, in a certain way, a leader. So nothing better than to start with a course about how to become a good leader and how to be able to manage a group.
And what have you got out of these few days? What do you think the most useful bits of the sessions have been?
I think that there were many of them. I think that in of course, you cannot learn how to be a leader in 2 days, but you can grasp the most important things. And now, actually, I have the things that I need to go and buy the books or check in internet and study a little bit more. I think that many of us, many times, we just focus on the science, but we forget about the admin personal stuff. So this actually, in some sense, it's an eye-opening.
I'm Nicole Grobert, and I'm based at the Department of Materials in Oxford. And my research focuses on the manufacturing of nanomaterials by design.
And why did you choose to come to this course about innovation and business skills?
It was just to basically meet people that I wouldn't normally meet, and also to find out about different aspects of life, things that we don't normally think when we work in a lab or are engaging with students.
What's been the most sort of useful sessions here?
Probably the most useful was to understand how I work, I mean, who I am. Because what happens when you go through your studies and then you get your postdoc and a fellowship, you basically at some point you stop getting supervision or you stop getting feedback from others or advice, and it's quite hard to find out where you're standing, how things are going, and trying to understand how one works, how one thinks, how one operates, helps to understand, to deal with other people. We get trained to develop an understanding and how to do science, scientific understanding. We learn methods. We learn to discuss with our peers. But communication outside the community is very different than when we communicate with people who are experts in our field. When you step up the ladder in your career, then you suddenly are facing other tasks that you need to deal with, and you never get any training in that matter, how to deal with people, how to manage people, how to manage research. And it's been very helpful to learn a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm Heiko Balster from the University of Leicester, and I'm professor in physical geography and director of a new research center, the Center for Landscape and Climate Research. Well, this is the third of these training courses I've been on by the Royal Society since I got my Wolfson Research Merit Award in 2011. What I really liked about them is that they opened my eyes towards the broader context and impact of research, and, you know, to think in the longer term and the broader context about things like commercialization, intellectual property, leadership styles, and all these different things. What I learned on this training course, I think, falls mainly into two areas. One of them is it's a good time away from the office to reflect on personality types and leadership styles and teamwork and the kind of soft skills you need as a manager. And the second part relates to managing organizational change and the things that you have to bear in mind when changing the way organizations function and how you can respond to externally changing environments.
Do you think there are particular reasons why it's useful for scientists as a particular group to come here and learn about these things?
Well, quite often I think we are a bit trapped in our treadmills in the lab, you know, when we just keep doing our day-to-day job. But sometimes I think you need an opportunity to take some time out and to reflect on how you do your job rather than what you do.
As well as leadership effectiveness, the two other modules in the Innovation and Business Skills series are on science and the economy and scientific entrepreneurship. Details about all of them can be found on our website.
At the last summer science exhibition, we asked schools to come up with the best question for one of our exhibitors. The two winning schools, Britannia Village Primary School and Wimbledon College, received a visit of a scientist at their school and got the chance to interview them about their work. Chris Harrison from the University of Durham visited Britannia Village Primary School and was asked a lot of questions about space.
Is it possible that photosynthesis can bring life on Mars?
So that's a good question. So in theory, yes, you could have the same processes on Mars as we have on Earth to have life. So, you know, plants require photosynthesis to create life. The problem is, at the moment, there are no plants on Mars that we are aware of. So if you were to be able to get a plant onto Mars and to be able to make it grow, then it could undergo photosynthesis. The problem with Mars is there's less oxygen there. It's a lot colder there than it is here. So the plants on Earth aren't necessarily going to be able to survive on Mars. But what you could do is you could build a special greenhouse. So you might have seen like the Eden Project and big greenhouses. If you could build something like that on Mars, you could create the right temperatures, the right amount of oxygen and these sort of things, put plants in them, and then they could grow just like they are on Earth, and maybe use the sunlight and use photosynthesis like you suggest.
Do you think it's possible that Earth is the only planet that has life on it?
It's certainly possible, because as far as we know, well, so far we haven't found life anywhere else. So today, as far as we know, Earth is the only one. However, if we consider how many planets there are in the universe, it seems very unlikely that we're the only one. So we do the numbers. There are about 8 planets in our solar system, and our star, the Sun, is the center of that solar system. In our Milky Way, the galaxy, just our local group of stars, there are about 100 billion stars. So if every one of those stars had, let's say, about 10 planets around it, that's 1,000 billion planets just in our galaxy. if you think how many galaxies there are in the universe, there's about 100 billion galaxies. So you have to take 1,000 billion, times it by 100 billion, and that's maybe how many planets there are in the universe. So are we the only one that has life on? Maybe, but it seems very unlikely, considering how many planets there are.
Can you compare dark matter to gravity?
Gravity is the only reason that we know dark matter even exists. So the only thing that we know about dark matter is it's the effect of gravity that it has. So you're probably familiar with the idea that the Earth goes around the Sun, and that's because of the gravity of the Sun. Because of the gravity, it goes round and round. Well, we see things moving around, stars and things moving around in space, around this invisible stuff, this dark matter. So we see this dark matter, we see the effects of gravity, which is what makes the stars and the galaxies move the way they do, but that's all we know about it. So gravity is really the only thing that we know about dark matter, the effects of dark matter, the effect of gravity that dark matter has.
What forms meteor rocks in space?
Good question. So there are bits of rock flying around in space, and meteorites, meteors, asteroids, you'll have heard all of these names. The ones that are in space you mainly call asteroids, but they're all kind of the same thing. These rocks probably formed, well, we know they formed at the same time as the Earth formed. But something that we don't understand very well is exactly how all of these rocks formed, or even how the Earth formed. What we believe is there was lots of gas and bits of dust around in space, and these slowly clumped together. So you got these bits of gas and dust clumped together to make bigger bits of dust, and they clumped together to make even bigger bits, and they clumped together, and you end up with bigger, bigger bits of rock. And eventually these crush under their own gravity, under their own weight, and you end up with a rock. And that's your meteorites. And some of those just floated around and stayed where they were, or meteors or asteroids. And then the rest of them clumped together even more to make planets, like the Earth and Mars and the other planets. But that's kind of a guess. We've got some belief that that's what happened, but we don't know everything about how these things were formed.
Paul Kirk, a mathematician from Imperial College, visited Wimbledon College and was interviewed about his research and how he works with other scientists.
Hi, my name's Christian, and I'm here with Ben and Dominic at Wimbledon College School. We're here because we won the Summer Science Exhibition, Ask a Scientist competition, and our prize was to have a scientist come to our school. And I'll now pass you to Dominic for the first question.
Thank you. The first question is about asking about the research you've done on your subject. It's about why are these proteins different and why do they change?
Great, thanks very much. Okay, so I am a researcher at Imperial College London, and I'm involved in theoretical systems biology. I work at the theoretical systems biology group there, and we're particularly interested in how proteins and genes work together in order to make things happen and the mechanisms by which these things happen. And basically, proteins are encoded for by genes in the DNA, and different genes code for different proteins, and there are lots and lots of different genes in the human body, and small changes can happen to the DNA called mutations. And if these are advantageous, so if these give some benefits, then it's possible that they will be carried forward to the offspring, so to your children, and then this might result in a change in the proteins over time in the process called evolution.
And what different fields of work do you collaborate with?
So I'm a mathematician originally, and I spend a lot of time working with a lot of biologists and also other biomedical scientists. So I work quite a lot with medical doctors, but also we work a lot with chemists and physicists who produce a lot of different technological advances in order to allow us to ask different questions and to get new types of information from biological cells and biological organisms.
And specifically, what part of biology do you find most interesting?
So I guess that's quite an easy question for me. I like maths and I like numbers. So now quantitative biology and computational biology are both very big fields, and they're the things which really interest me, because biology is generating so much data now, and it's quite difficult to extract useful and meaningful information from all this data. And it's only really by using lots of sort of complicated and sophisticated maths and lots of computational power that we're really able to answer the questions that we want to be answered from the data that we have.
Every year, the Royal Society runs its pairing scheme, matching research scientists with MPs, senior civil servants, and this year, even a Lord. The aim is to help MPs and civil servants establish long-standing links with practicing research scientists and to help research scientists understand how political decision-making really happens. The pairs kick off with a week in Westminster, which includes all kinds of sessions, exposing the research scientists to Westminster life.
We popped in on the first day. First, we spoke to Dr. Chris Tyler, who is director of the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. He talked about the role that the pairing scheme can play. We then spoke to some of the scheme participants to find out what they hope to get out of the time spent with their pair.
Why do you think that the Royal Society's MP pairing scheme is a useful thing for MPs and for scientists to be involved in?
Well, MPs are charged by the UK to make laws, debate policies, and to scrutinise the work of government. It's extremely important work. And a large part of that is their work has been informed by evidence. The generators of that evidence are researchers, a lot of them in academia, some in industry, NGOs and so on. But the interface between the people who are generating evidence and the people who are making decisions that affect our lives is not always as fluid as it might be. So schemes like this are extremely important for building connections between the people who are generating knowledge on the one hand and the people who are making decisions for us on the other.
So for the MPs and scientists going into the start of this week, what do you think the key things they should be trying to get out of it are?
I think the most important thing is to get a feel for how this place operates. It's an extremely strange place to come as an outsider. Everything is extremely political by design, and getting one's head around the culture of Parliament and its role in the wider policymaking process works is really important. The second thing that I think is really important is the building of connections between individuals. It's all very well building a science advisory infrastructure and writing reports on science advice and trying to feed it into the policy process, but ultimately decisions get made through connections between people. One of the things I love about the pairing scheme is it connects individuals together as much as provides people with a platform to learn new things.
I'm Catherine Wood and I'm based in Oxford. I'm Professor of Immunology.
I'm Nicola Blackwood. I'm the Member of Parliament for Oxford West and Abingdon. I did the pairing scheme in 2010 and I was paired with Professor David Walk, who is a particle physicist, and I found it incredibly valuable, just opening up a whole vista of science and technology, which I hadn't fully understood before, and I found it really valuable in trying to represent a whole research community in my constituency. And I really wanted to do it again and try and understand a different field. And when I applied this time and Professor Wood's name came up, I thought this was ideal.
I hope I'll learn a lot so that actually I can be more effective in the way that I approach parliamentarians to try and influence their approaches to new therapies in the future.
Well, I think one of the things that I find as a member of Parliament is I'm often required to learn about very technical things very quickly and have an opinion about them and often vote on them. And having access to experts who can explain the details of them and the way that my decisions would affect them in the field and in their profession is very valuable. And so providing expert opinion on specific areas of policy interest, I think, would be very helpful indeed.
I'm Saif Shaheen. I'm Professor of Respiratory Epidemiology at Barts and the London School of Medicine, which is part of Queen Mary University of London. My research is all about trying to find the causes of respiratory diseases like asthma.
And who have you been paired with through the MP pairing scheme?
Well, I'm really chuffed to have been paired with Professor Lord Robert Winston.
And what attracted you to the scheme? Why did you apply to be involved?
Well, thinking ahead, on the back of my research, if I get to the stage where the evidence suggests a causal link between a lifestyle risk factor, let's say it's to do with diet and asthma, for example. I'm doing quite a lot of research at the moment on selenium, some evidence that low selenium in the diet might be linked to asthma risk. It may be that we'll get to the stage where there'll be alternative policies advice to people about what we might do. One might be simply to pop a selenium pill. On the other hand, for example, there may be an argument for doing something at a higher level, for example, enriching fertilizers with selenium to increase the selenium uptake in crops. And something like that would need action at government level. And I have no idea how you make that step from strong scientific evidence to translating into real public health policy change.
And aside from schemes like this, are there other things that you think could happen to try to improve understanding between politicians and scientists of how they work and how their work is useful to each other?
Things like, in my field, communicating risk is a concept that certainly the lay public often find difficult to grasp. And there are things like that where scientists, we could do better to improve the understanding of the public and the politicians about issues like that.
I'm Julian Huppert, the Member of Parliament for Cambridge.
Jatinder Singh, a research associate at the University of Cambridge Computing Laboratory.
And why were you interested in taking part in the Royal Society MP pairing scheme?
I've been involved every single year since I was elected in 2010, partly because I used to be a scientist. For me, it's a great chance to learn about bits of science that I know nothing about.
Basically, I just want to get an idea of the sort of political process, how kind of you can turn concepts or concerns from the research world into sort of pragmatic steps. So lots of the research I do tends to be on the more applied side of computer science, you know, systems, security, that sort of thing. Very topical issues at the moment. So I sort of wanted to work out a way I could actually engage with, you know, the political process.
Are there particular things that you think that your perspective can bring to your partner's work, or are you more in it to learn from them?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, there are lots of things, just talking to Jat briefly now, which fit absolutely with some of the key decisions we're having to make. So what I hope I can offer Jat is hopefully an interesting time, an interesting experience, a sense of what's going on here and why, but hopefully also perhaps making sure that what he knows and what he can advise makes a difference to what government actually does.
Well, certainly for me it's to, you know, be able to have a greater impact, so as Julian says, you know, faster sort of get your research out there and actually make a difference.
Do you think that there are broader things or different things that can help to increase understanding between the two sides of this divide?
The easiest thing to do is for a lot of people to go and see their MP. Almost every MP does a surgery. And when there is an issue which you know about, offer to advise them on it, because most MPs will admit that they don't know, we don't know everything about everything.
That's it for this episode. We will see you back in January for the first episode of 2014. Until then, don't forget you can keep in touch with the Royal Society on Facebook and Twitter.